We read for you. Atlantis, the Dark Continent. A book by Paul Williamson and Linda Braithwaite. Read by JP on Wolf Spirit Radio. Atlantis, the Dark Continent. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio.
Well, I hope you're still listening to Wolf Spirit Radio. Anyway, hello. It's me again, but this time I'm talking with the mic faded up and you're able to hear what I'm about to say. So, this is chapter 16 of the book, where I think we're at episode 9 now. Out of a probable 12, it's probably, it looks like about the, that number of pages. So we'll see exactly how many. But let's go through this one. This could be quite triggering. My warning. That's what I was saying when I was faded up. This chapter may be quite triggering. It's about military and the rise of the military and the reasons for the military and things like that. So let's see where it all arose. Chapter 16, The Rise of the Military. Military rule. My impression from various regression sessions to my own past lives and that of others is that following on from the Golden Age, Atlantis became less and less a pleasant place to be. There were still pockets of peace, places where people dedicated themselves to spiritual work, places of simplicity and beauty. However, this was not at the heart of the community anymore. With population conditions becoming more crowded in the north, there came to be a defined class divide between rich and poor. At this time, typical personality traits of the Atlantean people were for them to be proud, passionate, and ambitious. However, when these characteristics were not molded with spiritual influences, were not molded with spiritual influences and a sense of needing to serve others and the greater whole, these qualities could easily become arrogance and cruelty. This, combined with the psychic sensitivity which many of these people had, could be a very volatile mixture. I've lit the story candle, by the way.
Yes.
The sense of common purpose among the people grew weaker, and instead people were concerned primarily with looking after their own position and interests. This grew into a very selfish society, and was the breeding ground increasingly for power struggles of all kinds. The strong energies in Atlantis made some people believe they could get away with anything. With it being quite a permissive society, the richer people tended to concentrate their attention upon fulfilling any kind of desire that they might have. But these desires were not always sensitive to the needs of others. For souls incarnating during this period, I'm sure it was a testing time. Unless people retreated to the healing sanctuaries, there were always the temptation of corruption of all kinds. I believe that many souls made serious mistakes, and much suffering was brought forth without people fully realizing the consequences of what they were doing. I'm not consciously aware of a complete picture concerning my own soul path through this time. However, I know that my progress was somewhat mixed. There were positive lives where I engaged in healing work and I did much good, working with love and caring. In other experiences, I made some mistakes but did not deviate too far away from my purpose. There are two lives I know where I actually killed someone, but the effect of this jolted me so much that I spent the rest of my life following a healing path. In both instances, the person whom I killed was Linda's soul. However, I did not completely manage to steer clear of corruption. In a few lives, my heart was closed and I did not care. During these experiences, I caused hurt and suffering to others. Mostly, I did not choose the worst of excesses that I could have done. But there were two lives where I did not avoid this, and these were the darkest and most negative experiences for me while in Atlantis. Oh, I see, you refreshed nothing because you thought, all right, okay, I get you. All right, okay, so, yes. Okay, here we go. I just want to interject here because several years ago, I remember speaking about this to Dave Corso about the crystal implants in Atlantis. And I looked and looked and looked and couldn't find this book. About 4 weeks after he died, this book turns up. This is one of the reasons I'm reading it. This lifetime he's talking about. Because probably this is closest to what we're seeing now in the darkest of black ops and in the paperclip and the whole MKUltra situation. So... it's not new. This is 13,000 years ago. Okay, back on the book. The first of these lives was that of a. The first of these lives was that of a. I'll try again. Just reinsert my teeth into my ears. Okay, the first of these lives were that of the crystal implant scientist, which I have written about in the previous chapter. It confronts me a little to consider that this life could have been worse. Oh, sorry. It comforts me a little to consider that this life could have been worse. What strikes me about this life is that as this character, with my heart closed, I was almost blinded to the extent of suffering which I was causing to others. He did not care. At least he chose not to share his secrets with the military. But he left a large trail of destruction behind him with karmic consequences to follow. The other dark life is worse. In this life, I was a female and sexually abused by my father as a child. I grew up to hate men and I passionately wanted to crusade for women's rights. As an adult, I joined a women's group who met at an earth sanctuary and engaged in rituals to honor the Dark Mother and to promote the power of the feminine. These rituals involved human sacrifice, sexual abuse, torture, and offering blood to this Dark Mother energy. Later, I became leader of this group, and I enjoyed what I was doing. One day, a male healer was brought to be sacrificed. I felt his love and his peace. This shocked me. Until then, I had never believed that a man could be loving to a woman. Suddenly, to my horror, I realized what I had been doing, and I left the group immediately. Shortly afterwards, I committed suicide. With Linda, the pattern of her lives was somewhat different to mine. The lifetime as Sophira affected Linda's soul deeply. Desperately, she wanted to turn this experience around, to learn from it and make amends in some way. But she kept failing and not keeping to the life path she had chosen as a soul. I think a pattern developed where she tended to build an inner wall around herself to protect herself from hurt. But this also isolated herself from others. So, instead of reaching out to others with love, she sought to acquire power over others as a substitute for this. Ultimately, though, this made her feel even more alone. In life after life, she continued to play this out, and some of these experiences were very negative indeed. Sometimes, when her gentle side could be nourished in supportive family environments, her sensitivity could flourish, and she could live beautiful, healing lives. The problem for her came when conditions were a little bit more difficult, when the personality she chose had ambition and drive. In these situations, it was very hard for her to be able to trust others. About 12,000 BC, that's 14,000 years ago, the society in the north of Atlantis had grown in population, so that there were large cities scattered along the coast. These were administered by military rule. In places, the military were quite oppressive, and people enjoyed much less personal freedom than they had previously. This led to situations of struggle and conflict. For Linda and I believe that we both considered that we needed to try and make a concerted effort to turn around from mistakes we had made and tendencies that had developed in both of us to act out negative lives. For me, after the life as the crystal implant scientist and the female life involving ritual sacrifice, I needed to learn in situations where cold ambition and strong drives to succeed were dominant in me, not to blind myself to the needs of others and to allow my compassionate side to express itself. If I was to let this trend go any further in a negative direction, I knew it would be disastrous for me as a soul. In Linda's case, she needed to learn to love people again, to be a kind rather than causing pain and cruelty to others. There was a need for her to let the walls down so she could feel connected with others rather than isolated. She needed to learn that it was safe for her to let her sensitive side come to the surface. To try.
Oh, yeah.
Hit me. Stop yawning, everybody. Somebody out there is yawning, I can hear you. To try. Hang on, sip of tea. To try to accomplish these goals, we each chose a life to live at the time with strong, ambitious personalities. The life I chose was one where I would be born into a family with a military tradition, with a father who was a forceful and powerful influence on my life, as one who was proud and successful in a military career and wanting his son to follow in his footsteps. My mother in that life was more gentle and compassionate, and so the two influences were there. The life Linda chose was one of more middle-class values, where she was born with the ability and drive to outdo her parents, to move higher in the strata of that society. Her parents were kind, but a little withheld in their love. It was really going to be up to her to create her own life. Both the personality Linda chose and mine were inclined to want to join the military, which was the power base of life in the city at the time. With torture and killing being standard practices within that establishment, there was plenty of temptation to allow the less caring side of each personality to become dominant. I do not think that Linda's personality and mine were so closely connected in that life. We both had our independent lives to live, but we were working and jostling for position in the same military establishment. What follows are the regression transcripts of how each life unfolded. Paul's regression, military commander Arun. All the way back. I'm standing in front of our family home, admiring the view below me. The house is situated on the slopes of the hills overlooking our city, with the sea and the harbour in the far distance. It is a very prestigious position where we live. I see in front of me a beautiful green canopy of trees and grassland stretching downwards. I enjoy very much the spaciousness of our grounds and the grandness of our house where I live with my family. My father has worked very hard in his career as a military officer to attain the rights to have a place like this. There are few who have done better or who live higher than us. I am proud of him and would also like him to be proud of me, and so I am following in his footsteps. Recently, I have begun training in the local military establishment. I am a young man in my early 20s. Today is one of those rare rest days when I can get away from the barracks and enjoy the luxuriant space of our family home. My father is just retired, but he is still active. He is encouraging me in my chosen career path. Within the community, my father has a good position and has gained respect. Our house is a symbol of his position. I also have one brother who is not at the military school. He is actually quite different from me and doesn't have my ambition. His interest is more in making things, working with cloth, carpets and such like. I think he has been somewhat of a disappointment to my father. But this is what he wants, and he is closer, in fact, to my mother, so I don't have a lot of time with him. He is now living down in the town, learning his trade, and is younger than me. The city where we live is large. There is quite a lot of commerce, trade through shipping, and there's also a large centre of learning, a university. We live in the north side of our land. Our harbour is an important gateway for shipping. In the winter time, it can get quite cool here. With it being such a sizable centre of population, much organisation is needed to keep everything running smoothly. The military has a strong and important role in this. We have to learn about management of people, of organisations, how to bring discipline and order to the region which we control. I'm doing my training in the barracks of the fortress on the hill overlooking the harbour in the city. The room where I stay is not very big and I feel rather closed in at times. We have to do drill and physical exercises, psychological training and horsemanship. Most of this I find quite tedious, and I'd rather escape sometimes into the countryside, riding my horse and feeling more freedom. I take advantage of this whenever I can. There is a need for me to be quite... There is a need for me to be quite patient with the training. With most of these officers who are teaching me, I feel I could do a better job than them. Their ways of teaching me are often quite stupid, but I have to go along with it because I know the need to obey. By obeying them and being loyal, I hope that I will get into a position where they will notice me, and where eventually I may be able to get promotion. Then I won't need to be taking other people's orders, but I can help this operation to become more efficient. As part of our training, there are occasions when we are assigned to groups of trainees and officers who go out into the streets and are called to attend to small-scale conflicts amongst the population. This has sometimes resulted in scuffles, people resisting arrest or sorting out rivalries between people. At times, then, I've had to use my sword and shield as a defense to look after myself and the other military personnel around me. This is something I've been able to take in my stride. I feel myself quite physically strong and able to look after myself. Within the city, there are various healing temples, and there's an... Oh, God. Sorry. Hit my lap. Reading lap. In the way. Okay. Within the city, there are various healing temples, and there's an old nature sanctuary in the hills. I feel that many people are finding these places less interesting than perhaps they did in the past. Maybe for some people these spiritual places are a comfort. It is not something that I have investigated very much. For me, I know that it is the life I am living now that counts. I want to make the most of that and achieve as high a position as I can. I want my father to feel proud of me, and for me to feel proud of myself, so that I know I have really worked to the best of my ability, and I have expressed the skills to my, and that I have expressed my skills to the full. When we have tests and assessment within the training, usually I can quite easily do better than my contemporaries. So I feel I am on my way. Socially, I do not have a partner. Actually, I do not have many friends. There is no need for me to find closeness with other people. I know what I am seeking to do. If I get too close to other people, they might distract me from my purpose and from fulfilling my ambitions. Even among the female military personnel or civilians, I have not sought their company to any great extent. I try not to have favorites with my colleagues. Besides, I do not know how far I could trust others. It is easier and safer for me to keep myself somewhat detached. Now I have finished my training. I have my own quarters within the barracks. Already I have gained some promotion. There are men and women whom I command. It has been noticed now how I can manage people very well without my emotions getting in the way of what I do. I've learned to be quite clinical in my approach to tasks. When I'm given orders, I will listen carefully and carry out those orders accordingly. This is gaining me respect. As I am making progress, my ambition is becoming more focused. The position I really want is to become in charge of this establishment. The man there now is not capable of doing nearly as good a job as I do. I would like to take his position if I could. Anyway, he's getting rather old now. Gradually, I am angling towards achieving this goal. Perhaps in a few short years, if all goes well. I have my strategy. There are some rivals, of course. But I think the best way forward is for me to make sure, especially when my commanding officer assigns a job to me, that I do this job totally according to his satisfaction and expectation. So then perhaps I can become his favorite. If I do my work well, then he can learn to rely on me and value me as someone he can depend on. Then he may more and more regard me as the ideal candidate to follow on from his example. I do not care what my colleagues want when working with them. However, I am very interested in what my commanding officer tells me to do, and to this and this I follow to the letter. It is not of much concern to me how my colleagues and contemporaries react. I hold my own, and I am fairly well respected. Because I am polite and courteous, I do not cause fights or aggravations among these people. I leave them to get on with their job. As long as they can leave me in peace, I will leave them in peace. It's not something where I feel I need to tread on their toes. Of course, if somebody else wants to do a job for the commanding officer, I generally make it my business to show that I could do the job better and demonstrate this whenever I have the opportunity. But really, I'm not wanting to cause any animosity with my colleagues. I know that if I did cause animosity, they would only be my enemies later, and this would not do. I just want to do my job well and fulfill my ambition. Some of the officers like to show off their uniform. It could look very splendid with our sash, stockings and shield. But this is of no importance to me. We have different uniforms for different occasions. When we are on duty in combat situations, we carry a sword, dagger and shield, and wear a toughened leather-like shirt to protect the upper part of our body from attack, and there are hardened gloves. Usually, I like to wear our plainer uniform when I can. I don't need to show off. My commanding officer is more interested in what I can achieve than what I look like, so that is where I put my energy. On occasions, there are riots in the city. Unfortunately, not all the population are always content with our policies. Some of them do not like to be controlled. However, if we were not there to control them, there would be very likely a lot of civil chaos. In a city of this size, you need order. People need some sense of authority to know what is expected of them, what they can get away with, and what they can't. Because we rule with a firm authority, there are those who object to us at times, and they try to express their civil rights. Sometimes they express opposition to what we are doing. This is something which my commanding officer and I look upon rather harshly. People should be sensible enough to realize that we offer the best alternative for them. For us, discipline is very important. My colleagues must do what I tell them when I command them. Otherwise, they will be punished. I prefer to work through praise rather than punishment, but the punishment is there as a last resort if needed. The soldiers who work with me know that I am strict, so if they do not obey me correctly, it can be hard for them. With civilians, it is similar. I give clear instructions to people where necessary. If they do not respond positively, then they too can be punished. For my soldiers, if they rebel from a situation where they are called to fulfill some duty, they may be beaten. There is a courtyard within the barracks where we do this. If their disobedience is more severe, they may be expelled from the military establishment, provided it is safe for us to do so. Otherwise, they may be held as a prisoner in one of our cells, or even executed. We use execution as a punishment mainly for people who are a threat and danger to the community and come from the population at large. We have special execution chambers for this purpose. When people cause trouble and disruption to our society, then we cannot really tolerate them being with us. It is better for them to be dead. We try to be discriminative about this and would not want to execute everybody. In fact, we try to be very selective about this. But if someone will not accept our leadership and authority in any form, or perhaps causes havoc in some other way, say through robbery or murder, then it is possible they will be executed. And this is really for two reasons. One would be just to remove them from society, so our people may live in peace. And the other reason would be really as an example to the other people in the society, to those who may likely be tried to say... to those who may be likely to try the same thing. We feel that basically we need an orderly society around us where people can get on with their business. And we are the ones who can provide this. We can provide leadership, and people need to accept this. When they do, everything is fine. Sometimes I am asked to attend these executions. Of course, my commanding officer has wanted to see me perform this side of the work as much as any other. I do believe he is watching me quite closely with an eye to the future. So I have not wanted to disappoint him with this. On occasions, I have needed to perform these executions myself. It is late now. I am in the execution chamber. There is a woman who is here. She has been tied up in the usual chair-like device we have arranged. As is customary, she has been stripped naked and restrained with straps around her feet, hands and waist. We have to take these precautions to protect ourselves. This woman has been causing a lot of trouble in the town. She's someone who feels that the military rule is wrong. She has also had relatives who have been executed by us. It is clear that she hates the military establishment, but she's been stirring others up to trouble. During a recent riot, she injured one of my colleagues rather badly. She had a knife and tried to attack him. As a result, she has been arrested and brought to the execution chambers. I don't enjoy these situations very much, because I must say that, in myself, I don't really like to kill. But today, my commanding officer is here with me. He is watching me, so I know I have to be quite clinical and do what is required. What I need to do, basically, is to remind her of the crime she's committed, remind her of the punishment that this incurs, and then regretfully tell her that this demands her to be killed, and I have to be the one to kill her. There is a special sword we have for this purpose. Usually, this is thrust into the chest of the person concerned. I've been taught to where to insert this weapon, so as to cause a quick and almost painless death. This is what I intend to do with this woman. She's arguing with me, though, and I think she is quite frightened about what is to happen. I don't really want to hurt her any more than is necessary. But I know I need to do my duty. Actually, I have to shout above her screaming and abuse to tell her what she has done. She's struggling as much as she can. I can tell she's desperate. But I have to do this, and I will do it. I have the sword in my hand, and I want to do this fairly quickly to give her the least amount of time to build up fear within herself, just so it can be done. I come forward. For a moment she looks in my eyes, and I see a depth to her, and a sadness. My heart is pounding. I've hesitated for a moment, but I know I must not hesitate, because my commanding officer is watching. I thrust the sword in, but she moves. Just as I put it in, she jerks it as much as she can sideways. I've not found quite the right place. This makes me very angry because my commanding officer is here. She is not quite dead as quickly as she could be. Blood is pouring from the wound, and I am embarrassed by this. I wanted to make a good clean kill for my commanding officer to witness. I wish she hadn't done that. There is little I can do. Now she is slumped and dead. I wish she hadn't done that. She caused extra suffering for herself. I did not want this. I feel regret for having killed her in such a way. I must not show this. I must go and sign the records and do that necessary work, so I know I have satisfied the requirements of my duty. It is later. I am now the commanding officer, having risen to that position. Actually, it was quite an easy transition. There was no one else really considered for the post, and it was acknowledged that I could do the job better than others. Now, I have been the commanding officer for some time, basically enjoying my work quite well. I am well pleased with the organization I have been able to establish. I think that people under me respect me and generally carry out my orders. Now, I am in my mid-30s and in the prime of my life. In some ways, though, I am also going through somewhat of a crisis inside myself. Now I am in my mid-30s and in the prime of my life. In some ways, though, I am also going through somewhat of a crisis inside myself. It's nothing which I tell to my fellow officers and colleagues from other military establishments, or certainly to my subordinates. The thing is, I know that I have risen in this job as high as I can go. I have actually achieved my ambition, and I have achieved it quite early in my life. At times, I find I am able to do my job easily, without too much effort, being rather used to it, in fact. But I'm wondering what else I can do in my life. It's like I feel an emptiness inside. I feel I don't know where my ambition can express itself anymore. I'm questioning myself. We have captured a man who is quite interesting, and something of a philosopher. He is someone who was taken from the town. Really, he has been causing us a lot of problems because he has been talking to groups of students at the university, getting them interested in other ideas, other forms of community beside military rule. He's been able to incite many of these students to join forces against us. This for us, of course, is unacceptable. Strangely, though, although I know he needs to be killed, I've sometimes visited him in his cell to talk with him. I found it rather interesting to listen to his ideas. He speaks a lot about the meaning of life, but this is not the main aspect of him which I find interesting. When other people are brought here, they tend to be very afraid. They tend to react, either becoming very timid and shell-shocked, or else they become rather abusive and they try to argue with us all the time. It really becomes quite tedious for us, all this, but he is different. He has been quite calm. It has been as though he has remained rather unaffected by his predicament, and this quite fascinates me. So, I'm interested just to listen to him and find out more about his ideas. It is not as though I would want to do anything else career-wise. However, I'm going through this questioning time in my life, and it is like there is some opening in me. I am wondering what other possibilities exist. He is quite a deeply religious man, sometimes sitting in his cell very quietly with his eyes closed. I know that his thoughts are somewhere else. Sometimes it is as though he is not even there. What I feel when I go near him is that there is quite a strong energy of peace around him. I don't find that amongst the other prisoners, and I certainly don't find it among the other officers in the barracks. I must say that I find this piece somewhat interesting, although I also find it disconcerting, because he does not seem upset that he is going to die. He even challenges me about this, and I must say that my inner feelings of justification for killing him are wavering. I will have to be the one to perform the execution. In this case, I want to do it myself. Some of my subordinates now are getting involved in long, arduous processes of torture and condemnation of prisoners, leading to agonizing deaths. I would not like them, any of them, to work with him. I think he is someone whom I respect. If he is to die, he deserves a quick and painless death. The actions of some of my subordinates is getting somewhat out of my control. They use torture to gain information. Sometimes we need to use more physical methods of interrogation when prisoners are withholding information that is important to us. But I feel that some of my subordinates are finding means to bring suffering to prisoners that is unnecessary and often excessive to what I consider is needed. It is hard for me to do anything about it, though, because within our establishment, there is an unwritten rule that as far as the execution of prisoners is concerned, there is no limit to the way this is done. It is discretionary, according to the judgment of the officer responsible for a particular prisoner. So, there is a permission for them to do what they do, and I would not want to be seen as weak by interfering. Generally, I try to tolerate what they do. In the past, anyway, I felt it was their own business. It wasn't any concern of mine whether they tortured them or whatever they did. They were just condemned prisoners. With this man, though, somehow I am beginning to feel differently. He also seems interested to talk with me. He doesn't seem to hate me or to fear me, like other people do when they come here. That is interesting for me as well. He seems quite a lot more at peace with himself than anyone I've met. It is later now. I have, of course, postponed the execution as long as I could, signing several papers to indicate that he needed further questioning before this could be done. Put my teeth back and say that again. It is later now. I have, of course, postponed the execution as long as I could, signing several papers to indicate that he needed further questioning before this could be done. But it is difficult for me because the officers who brought him in for arrest have signed papers regarding the need to execute him. Even though I am the commanding officer, there are not really sufficient grounds for me to contradict this. So, he has to be killed. But I feel that if I have to kill him, then I don't want to kill anyone else. I feel I have done enough killing. He would never kill anyone. I don't believe that he did anything in his life to cause violence to others. Therefore, it feels a mistake to bring him here. Something about it is wrong. But I cannot show these feelings to others because I do not want to be seen to be weak. I have to maintain my permission. I have to maintain my position. He is rather quiet now. I think he has been interested to meet with me. However, I sense that he knows it is his time to die now. However, he is also sensitive and respectful. Although we have had several private conversations, he is not showing me up with my other colleagues who are here with me. I believe he also accepts that I will try not to cause him undue pain. But I don't like to do this. I don't like to cause him pain or to be the cause of his death. He does not deserve that. It's as simple as that. He just does not deserve it. I'm in the execution chamber, and the sword is in my hand. I don't want to look in his eyes, but he is closing them anyway. Again, I feel him becoming quiet, and it feels almost like a peace is coming from him. speaking in a very quiet voice to state what he is alleged to have done. I am not even sure that he hears. I take a very deep breath before I get my sword in position. Even so, I feel very nervous. I want to get this right, find the right place, so I can do it with as much care as I can. In the end, I come up to him quickly. I put the sword in and I know he is dead. I can hardly bear to stay. I feel I need to get away. Quickly signing the papers, I go to my room and lock the door. I sit for a long time, trembling. And I just feel that this is not the way. This is not the way to live my life. This is not the way. If I have to kill men that I respect. This man I respected more than any other person I have met, and yet I had to kill him. I don't want to have to do that again. For a long time I feel bewildered. I want to seek help or guidance, but I don't quite know what to do. I could stay in my position as commanding officer, but a part of me wants to leave. Somehow, I know that in my family, it would never do for me to leave this profession. My family would lose face. I would lose face. It makes me feel that I have to stay in my job. But I don't like it, and I just don't want it. I tell no one of my feelings. I could not tell them. If I did, I would be a laughingstock and would be hounded out of the job. They would probably torture me like they torture some of their victims. Amongst my colleagues, I feel there are one or two whom I have to watch very closely. I feel there are eyes upon me for any sign of weakness. However, while I continue to act firmly, clearly, and clinically as I always did, there is nothing really for me to fear. Overall, I still maintain the respect of the officers, but it is getting harder for me to keep up this act. There is something in me. I want to seek to find peace, like this prisoner had. I would love to find that peace in myself and know how he attained that. And his religious convictions were so sincere. I can understand now how others were affected by him and when he spoke to them. I just wish I could find a way to engender those feelings in myself. It might make it easier for me to bear this job I have. It is later. I am sitting in a clearing with the trees around me. The energies are strong here. This is the sacred nature sanctuary. To come here, I have left the town. It is situated in the hills, inland somewhat. I have been sitting on a stone and crying. I feel so much remorse for what I have done in my life. Such a waste. There is a man behind me. This is rather strange. He has his hands on my shoulders and sometimes my head, and they feel so comforting, so peaceful. And I just feel as if I am sitting here like lifetimes of suffering are just pouring out of me. I feel so weak and so ashamed. It feels so wrong what I have been doing, and I wish I could do better. I just feel that I am unworthy of anything. I have not asked about this man. He is just there, and I know he belongs with this place. It is not really my business. I just need help. When I come here, he appears and gives me help. He is here silently with me, seeming to speak more with his thoughts than words. And I hardly notice anyone else here. It is like I am alone with him, and the energy of the nature and the earth around me seem vast. I enjoy this solitude. It is good to have a break. In the military barracks, it feels claustrophobic to me. I don't like that place anymore. I don't like the killing. I don't like the torture. I don't like the authority. I don't like imposing our force on others. I don't like the oppression. I don't like the coldness. I struggle to know what I can do. Now I've got to this position, there's little else that I can do. I'm too old for any other form of work. I could not leave. Anyway, if I left, the oppression of that establishment of these military people would continue. It would get worse. It has been getting worse. The uprisings have been getting greater. People hate the military. They hate being ordered around. I just wish I could make it easier for them. I just wish I could. I'd like to make peace with them and find some peaceful coexistence between the people and the military. I'd like to do this. This idea has been growing in me. I have not talked much with anyone about it yet. I feel that this needs cautious planning, if I am to succeed. Some of the officers seem to be sympathetic to my idea. What I'm trying to tell them, really, is the more brutal we've come with the population, the greater will be their reaction. Brutality breeds violence on their side as well. This is what I feel. Some of the officers are listening to me. They are starting to modify their behavior somewhat. I still have some authority. But there are others who don't. It is very frustrating for me. I'm wanting to make changes like this. Some of those under me are not really concerned. I have to argue with them that my approach is not the only... I have to argue with them that my approach is the only way we'll be able to keep the power of the military strong. I don't really believe that because I don't want a military authority anymore, but I have to relate it on their terms. Now it is later. I am at a meeting, negotiating with people from the university. We are talking. We're talking about cooperation. I am listening to their demands, what they would like from the military to find greater freedom of operational expression. I feel that most of their demands, if not all of them, are quite reasonable. They want an end to the killing and the torture. I think they're right. But I have to be a bit careful in what I express is possible, because I cannot speak only on behalf of my own interests, but what I feel that my fellow officers could accept. There are one or two other officers with me negotiating at the table. There are people who I have come to know that are sympathetic, like me, to the principles of conciliation. There is this woman officer, Tarsha, who is at the door behind me. She is one I do not trust, but I've had to bring her because she is my next in command. She is taking care of security matters while we continue the negotiations. This woman officer is one who revels in cruelty. She seems to have a bloodlust about her which I find very difficult. And much as I try to talk with her, I can tell, whatever she says, that she does not agree with my line. I can tell in her eyes that she only wants to kill, and kill again. She does not care who she kills, and I think she is just one example of how our establishment has gone badly wrong. I fear that if I tried to remove her, she would get me first. She is very much aware of these tactical conspiracies. Throughout my working life, I have tried to stay clear of these kinds of manipulations and conspiracies, and act more through example to build up trust and get what I want that way. Now there has been a disturbance. My colleagues have come in. What? They want to arrest me. It's Tarsha's doing. I can see it now. She's there. I know exactly what she wants to do. I know this woman. She just wants to take over. She does not want these agreements, so I must stop her. No, she would torture me. What can I do? I must stop her. I will go to her. I'm going to her now. I will fight her. She will kill me now, because that is the best way. I do not want to kill her. I struggle with her. Yes, I could be stronger than her. I know I am. She stabbed me. I'm sinking down to the floor. I can feel it is over. I'm starting to rise up, feeling the peace. He's here, the one I killed. He's helping me, holding my hand. There are others too. I feel great waves of peace, and it feels such a relief. It feels like I've been through something dark and horrible, and now I can begin to breathe again. I feel there are many here. Those I killed, that woman, I hated to kill her. I really hated to kill her. I'm sorry I had to do that to her. Really sorry. She knows, because she could tell in my eyes that I didn't want to do it. She's forgiven me. I feel I was a fool in the way I was so blind to my ambition, not caring for anyone. I feel I was a fool in the way I was so blind to my ambition, not caring for anyone except myself and my family honor. What a big illusion. My father's here. He's here. There's a mixture of feelings. I know I fulfilled his expectations of me. He was proud of what I achieved. But we both know that what we aspired to was not really all we could have done. We were missing so much. He valued only my capacity to further my career, and I valued that too as a way to please him. This does not feel enough anymore. I think it was a good life, and I changed from having a dark, insulated way of being to where I started to care again for others and look for peace, instead of exerting my will over others to do what I wanted. I learnt in that life that there is more to achieve in life than just satisfying my ambitions. The main feeling around this life is one of relief. Relief to have got through it the way I did. I'm glad to be over it. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio.
Welcome to Wolf Spirit Radio.